The next few weeks, of course, are dedicated to the building of the Mishkan and the Bigdei Kahuna. This year is the Shana Me'uberes, so we get the full spread. Vayachal and Pekudei will get their own week. And it begins, of course, with Teruma, with the collection of donations, the beginning of Perek Kafhei, Daber Abnei Yisrael, the Yikhudi Truma, the Shetek Truma, Me'ez Kol Ish Hashed Venu Libo Tikhuas Trumasi, from anyone whose heart volunteers him, shall take the collection, the donations. And there are a number of Meforshim. The earliest I can see this idea is in the Alshech HaKadosh. But it's important because it represents, in a sense, the pnimius, what is going on inside the idea of Truma. The Pasuk states, Me'ez Kol Ish Asher Yudven Libo Tikhuas Trumasi, from anyone whose heart volunteers him. And the next Pasuk gives us the materials, V'zos HaTruma Shetikhu Me'itam, these are the elements and items and that you shall take from them, Zahav, Kesef, and Nechoshes, and it goes on. Rashi tells us there are 13 things, there seem to be more, 13 general items. And the Alshich states that we have an interesting project here, to build the Mishkan, to donate to the Mishkan. What is it exactly that we're giving to the Mishkan? What is asked of the Jewish people? What are they to give of themselves? The simple answer would seem to be all the materials that are enumerated, the gold and silver and the copper. And yet, ultimately we know that all those things, they're Hashem's anyway. Li ha-kesev, v'li ha-zav. But the pasuk actually says something else first. And that is, me'eis kol ish asher yidvenu libo. From each person, that which his heart volunteers him. That generosity and that dedication and that devotion that goes with the gift is actually what the Jewish people are really giving, because that's the only thing that doesn't belong to Hashem. As similarly, as we would say, Hakol bidei shamayim, chutz miyiras shamayim, everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. So too, Hashem owns everything except for the decision of the Jewish people to give it. That's in a sense is what they give. And that is outlined by the pasuk, v'yikholi truma, let them take donations from the Jewish people. And what are they taking? First and foremost, me'ez kol ish asher yudvenu libo tikhuas trumasi. That is what you're taking. You take their generosity. That's what they're contributing, ultimately. The next pasuk speaks on a more practical plane. And what are the materials? V'zos hatruma asher tikhu me'itam. And what the Alshich seems to be indicating is that as surely as the physical edifice of the Mishkan is constructed through the materials that are donated, but the essence of the Mishkan is constructed through the devotion that is given over by the Jewish people. And that's an important part of it, perhaps as important, if not more important, than all of the materials that Hashem owns anyway. Ultimately, the Mishkan, as any holy endeavor, is built and constructed of the devotion and generosity of the Bnei Yisrael. And it's interesting to see how later figures express this idea. There's an interesting comment of the Kotzke Rebbe, in the name of the Kotzke Rebbe, which relates to the beginning of Parshas Kisisa. There it talks about the Machzis HaShekel, and everyone gives the half a shekel. And the Pasuk states, Ze yitnu, this they should give, towards the beginning of Kisisa. And Rashi comments that Hashem showed Moshe matbea shel esh, a coin of fire, and said, this is what they shall give. The Medrash, and of course Rashi is responding to the fact that the word ze always has the connotation of something that you can see, something that you can point to. HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, Rashi says, Hashem showed Moshe what the moon should look like at Kiddush HaChodesh. Ba'avur Zeh, lo amarti, ele b'shah she'ishmatzu amor menachat lefanecha. And similarly, with regards to the Machzis HaShekel, Zeh Yitnu. The Medrash elaborates a little bit more, gives us the background that Moshe didn't really know how the Machzis HaShekel would look. And so Hashem showed him the Machzis HaShekel. Otherwise, why show him a Machzis HaShekel? You can show him the real thing, and the Jewish people have the real thing. I mean, they're about to give it to him. No one knows what a Machzis HaShekel looks like. If the only one that exists is one of fire that Moshe has shown, where does the Jewish people get their half shekels from? Apparently, it's not so difficult to come by. So why should it be hard for Moshe to fathom what the half shekel should look like? In our parsha, Rashi tells us that Moshe was not entirely sure what the menorah should look like, and Hashem showed a menorah of fire. It's easier to understand why one wouldn't know exactly what the menorah would look like, because who knows what it would look like until Hashem showed it. But half a shekel, if you don't know what half a shekel looks like, then... Well, it's a basic coin. So the Kotzke Rebbe explains that when it says that Moshe didn't understand what the Machzis HaShekel would look like, what it means is that for the average person, what does he give? He gives a half a shekel. What is that? That's not particularly impressive. And somehow from this the Mishkan will be built. From this the Avodah will proceed. What can come from half a shekel? Just money, and it's not a lot of money. And the answer was, Hashem showed him matbea shel esh. He showed him a coin of fire. Says the Kotzke Rebbe, if the half shekel is given as a coin of fire, great things can come from it. The coin of fire represents all of the excitement and all of the idealism that comes with half a shekel. It can go a very long way. And it's interesting to note, just to the other spectrum, side of the spectrum, the Kotzke Rebbe, of course, I don't know if he represents all of Hasidus, but from the Litvisher world, it is told that the Ponovitcher Rav was once in New York, and he was collecting for the Ponovitcher Shiva. Of course, the Shiva needs a good amount of money, and he'd made an appointment to meet with a certain gevir, and the amount was a good number of thousands of dollars. So he's on his way, and one of the local rabbonim is accompanying him. And as they're journeying to meet this gevir, so an elderly Jew stops the Ponovitcher Rav and says, "You're the Rosh Hashiva of Ponovitch?" "Yes, he's the Rosh Hashiva of Ponovitch." He said, "Rebbe, I have a donation for the yeshiva," said this elderly Jew. He didn't look like he had two pennies to rub together, but from the recesses of his coat, he pulls out a dollar. And the Ponovitcher Rav was delighted. And he says, "Let me have a receipt." He took out his receipt book. It could be the receipt was worth more than the donation. He took out the receipt book and he wrote him, "Receipt received, $1. And then this person had friends. And they also had a bit of money. And a queue began to form around the Ponovitcher Rav. And this one gave a dollar. And this one gave $2. And this one gave half a dollar. That's all they had. And the Ponovitcher Rav wrote a receipt for each and every donation. And he thanked them and sent them on their way. And the Rav who was, and they were getting late for their meeting with the millionaire. And the Rav was a little bit impatient. And he said to the Ponovitcher Rav, "I mean, to write or sit down and a receipt with the details for each and every one, I mean, we're on our way for a big donation." And the Ponovitcher Rav says, "These donations are very valuable because they're full of lishma. I mean, no one's going to get a plaque in the yeshiva for $1 or even $2. So there's nothing except their desire to help the yeshiva. And the yeshiva of Ponovitch is built on lishma, donations lishma, not just the amounts. Amounts are also important, but these are very valuable donations. It's very interesting. I'm reminded, as I saw the story, my uncle, Gershon, Cooperman, who's the oldest of the Cooperman brothers, she'll live and be well, he's headed for 90 now, remembers that the Ponovitcher Rav used to visit them in Ireland a number of times. He was collecting for the Ponovitcher Shiva, and my uncle Gershon recalled that the Ponovitcher Rav never asked anyone for money. He's collecting for the yeshiva, he never actually asked anyone to donate to the yeshiva. What he would do is he would just sit with you at the yeshiva. But Gershon said, if you knew the Panovich Rav, by the time he'd finished, you just felt that you wanted to be part of it. And people offered to give him money, which he accepted. He was collecting for the yeshiva. But he never actually asked. And it's interesting that that would seem to be in keeping with his approach, that the type of donations he was looking for was Asher Yidvenu Libo, that people wanted to give, so much so that he would prefer not to ask them, that they should offer instead. So I'm not sure how many other Rosh Hashivas could pull that off, but the Panovich Rav certainly was able to do so. And the moral of the story is, if we may borrow an expression which is more used elsewhere, but important for us, that it's not just the amount of the dollars in the donation that's important. The amount of donation in the dollars is also important. That's me'ez kol ish asher yidvenu libo. So we're in an interesting situation. I think this is one of the only discussions about collections that are taking place, being followed up by an actual collection. But nonetheless, the yesodos are important for the worthy causes as and when they come about. So these are the openings of Parshas Teruma. Now, Parshas Teruma has a mitzvah, and it's a mitzvah of Taryag. There is one, and that is in Pasuk Ches, V'asu li mikdash v'shachanti besocham. We have noted in the past that the V'asu li mikdash, the Rambam tells us, are the source of the mitzvah of building every mikdash, where applicable. Not only the Mishkan in its time, but also in subsequent occasions, first Beis HaMikdash, second Beis HaMikdash, and Bekorav, the third Beis HaMikdash, that is the fulfillment of the V'asu li mikdash. And the Rambam has a set of halachas that are devoted to the Binyan Beis HaMikdash, known as Hilchos Beis HaBechira in the Mishnah Torah. And there's a famous question that is generated by one of the rulings of the Rambam. Rambam states, this is in Hilchos Beis HaBechira, Perek Aleph, Halacha Yud Beis. Ein bonin es hamikdash balayla. The mitzvah of building the mikdash does not apply at night. And he quotes the pasuk, which relates to the Mishkan, actually. In the end of Shemos, it says, Uveyom hakim es hamishkan. That's actually based on the Gemara in Maseches Shavuos. Uveyom hakim es hamishkan. The Torah emphasizes by day. At day the Mishkan was set up. And again, for the Rambam, Mishkan, Mikdash, that's all the same. Beyom Mekimim, Velo Balayla. The building of the Mishkan, the setting up of the Mishkan takes place by day and not by night. And then the Rambam says, V'hakol Chayovim, Livnos, Ulasad Ba'atzmam, Uvimamonam. Everyone is obligated to build, to help, with their, through their efforts, through their donations, anoshim v'noshim, men and women, kamikdash hamidbar, like the mikdash of the midbar, that is to say, our mishkan. For we find that the women were involved in the putting together certain aspects of the mishkan. They spun the thread, tavu es ha'izim. They actually came first for the donations. By avo hanoshim al hanoshim. Chazal tell us the women came first, unlike the egel. And Rambam says that's true for all bote mikdash. It's a mitzvah that applies to all. And a classic question is raised on this ruling of the Rambam. Namely, we have a principle with regards to mitzvahs. Mitzvah sasesh man grama, a time-bound positive mitzvah, noshim peturos. Women are exempt. The Rambam, in the very same halacha, seems to have stated two contradictory things. He began by saying that the mitzvah of the building of the Mishkan, Mikdash, only applies by day, not by night. Uveyom hakimas ha-mishkan. That would seem to set it out as a mitzvah sase shazman grama. It's time bound. And the Rambam goes on to say that all are included in the mitzvah, all are obligated, anoshim, benoshim, kemikdash, hamidbar. Why are women obligated in the mitzvah of asuli mikdash if it's a time-bound mitzvah? This question was raised by the Beis Yitzchak, Reb Yitzchak Shmelkus of Lvov, a classic posek in Poland there in the 1800s, and many, many responses have been given. I would like to take a look at two of them. Each one is fascinating in its own way. And the first is from the Stipler Gaon, Rav Kanievsky, Rav Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky. in his Chidushim Kehilas Yaakov on Maseches Shavuos. And he explains as follows. Actually, we see from the Rambam that the mitzvah of Asuli Mikdash has two components to it. On the one hand, it is the setting up of the Mikdash. When we think of Binyan Beis HaBechira, to build the Beis HaMikdash, we think of building. True. But there's another aspect to it, and that is getting everything ready, even before anything is built, preparing the materials, and so on and so forth. Those preparations are also part of the mitzvah. And in fact, the Rambam said as much. For again, his words are, Hakol chayavim livnos, to build, ulesa'ad, and to prepare and help, ba'atzmam, themselves, b'mamonam, with their donations. Those things are preparatory in nature. They're getting things ready. And that's also part of the mitzvah. And that actually, if we take that as it seems, is the chiddush. Because normally we don't look upon the preparatory stages of a mitzvah as the mitzvah, but rather we would call them a hechsher mitzvah, enabling the mitzvah, as much as we call them loosely a mitzvah, but they're not an actual mitzvah. We say building a sukkah is a mitzvah. Loosely it's a mitzvah, but you don't make a bracha on it. It's not the mitzvah yet. The mitzvah is to live in the sukkah. If you didn't build one, there's nothing to live in. So you need it to enable the mitzvah. But that's a preparatory stage. It's not the mitzvah itself. Baking a matzah is not a mitzvah. As much as it's, we say it's a mitzvah to be involved, and one should be involved, but the mitzvah is to eat the matzah. You didn't bake, there's not what to eat. But that's a hechsher mitzvah. Preparing all the materials, getting the stones ready and getting the kelim ready and all of these things, they are preparatory stages. And the chiddush or the Rambam is all preparations are part of the Asur Mikdash, the Mamonim, even donating, which is even a stage prior to that, just providing the money for someone to do something with. The Rambam seems to include that is also in part of the mitzvah. And therefore it's quite a multifaceted mitzvah. At the apex, you have the actual setting up of the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash, but all the preparatory stages are also part of the mitzvah. And so, says the Stipler, when we say that the mitzvah of building the Mishkan or Mikdash only applies by day, and it's derived from the words, Uveyom Hakim Es HaMishkan, that only refers to the actual building of the Mishkan, setting it up. That is by day. But all of the other aspects of the mitzvah, the preparations and putting things together and getting things ready, etc., they are not restricted at all. It's possible to weave the threads at night, etc. And therefore, says the Stipler, we have before us a very interesting mitzvah. We could call it a mitzvah asei shechetzio azman groma. It's a positive mitzvah, part of which is time-bound, but part of which isn't. And therefore, the parts of which are not are really the parts that the women would be involved in terms of, as we see in the Mishkan, that they did the weaving and the spinning, etc. And that's not time-bound, that's why women are obligated. Very interesting presentation of the mitzvah, not only for this question, but for understanding of the mitzvah itself. A second approach is to be found, amongst others, in the Chidushim of Rav Yisrael Gustman Zatzal, who was a Rosh Hashiva here, actually very near here, in Rechavia, in Netzach Yisrael. Originally, he was a Rav in Vilna. He was a Dayan on Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski's Bezdin at the age of 18. He was something of a very, very special person, and he survived. In fact, he survived the war. He lived in a forest, ran away, fighting from the Nazis. And a number of years prior to the outbreak of the war, he was walking in the forest with Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski. And they were talking Divrei Torah, of course. What else is Reb Chaim Ozer going to talk about? But at some point in the conversation, Reb Chaim Ozer began to point out certain plants to him. And told him, this one is nutritious, this one is poisonous, this one is dangerous, this one is curative, and of course, Gustman remembered everything, but he was very puzzled as to why Reb Chaim Ozer would be saying this. Years later, he was in the forest and he survived off all of those plants that Reb Chaim Oza told him he was able to eat, etc. And in fact, when he came here, he was in America for a while, but when he came here in Eretz Yisrael, there was a garden in the front of the yeshiva. He tended himself personally to the garden. He had hakaras hatov to plants because they kept him alive during the war. Anyway, very, very special person. And his shiurim are very long and involved. I know a Talmud of his. He said the shiur would go for about 6 hours or so. So certainly not for the faint-hearted. And within the course of one of his shiurim, he addresses this question, and again to remind ourselves, the Rambam on the one hand says that building the Mishkan, Mikdash, seems to be a time-bound positive mitzvah, but the very next line says that all are obligated, anoshim v'noshim. And Rav Gusterman explains that the Sefer HaChinuch, when he comments on the words for Asuli Mikdash, explains that it's a very interesting type of mitzvah. Who is the mitzvah for? Normally when we talk about mitzvahs, who is the mitzvah for? Is it for men? Is it for women? Is it for both? How many people are obligated in this mitzvah? Here, the Sefer HaChinuch says that the mitzvah of building a Beis HaMikdash is a mitzvah on the tzibur. It's a mitzvah for the Jewish people as a composite entity to build the Mishkan. It's not like other mitzvahs where everyone has the mitzvah. Each and every person has the mitzvah. It's not a mitzvah for each and every person. Most people might not be practically involved in the Mikdash. But it doesn't mean that those who do build the Mikdash, the mitzvah is for them. They represent the tzibur. It's not their mitzvah. It's everyone's mitzvah. It's a mitzvah on the tzibur. And therefore, says Rav Gusterman, it seems to be quite clear that when we state this principle that women are exempt from time-bound mitzvahs, that's when it comes to mitzvahs that devolve on the individual, and there may be certain individuals that have the obligation and certain that don't, depending on whether it's time-bound. Whereas here, there's only one mitzvah for everyone. And anyone who's involved represents the tzibur. Who can represent the tzibur? Anyone who's part of the tzibur, says Augustine. And the tzibur is made up of men and women, and therefore a mitzvah like this, even if it's time-bound, if it's for the tzibur, it's for the entire tzibur, any and every member of the tzibur, and that's why there's no exemption, all a part of the mitzvah. And Augustine concludes and says, "This the afa pi shezechidush, even though this seems to be quite a new idea, nochon hu v'siyata d'shmaya." In my opinion, says Augustine, it is very correct. So, that is his approach to the question of Zman Groma versus everyone being involved in the mitzvah. So having mentioned one or two preliminary and general comments, I would like to look at a certain feature of the Mishkan, which I personally consider to be most fascinating, and that is the paroches. And of course, we have our own paroches, and it's modeled on that paroches. I should say Lahavdil, but that might be appropriate. But that is to be found in Perek Kafvav, Pasuk Lamed Aleph. And let us take a look at how the Torah introduces the paroches. Chamishi, Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Vasisa paroches. So one of the things to be made, and the Mishkan has so many different aspects, is the paroches. And it has the following materials, techeles, agaman, tolashani, v'sheish mashzar, all of those materials woven together, and they make the curtain called the paroches. Interestingly, Rashi comments on the word paroches. What does paroches mean? So we have an instinctive translation. We say paroches means curtain. That might not be entirely accurate. Rashi comments, paroches, loshon mechitzahu. Paroches means a divider. That's what a paroches means. Uvaloshen chachamim. What is the word that the chachamim would use for this? Pargot. Again, a divider. It's a common expression in the parlance of Chazal. Kach shamati me'achari ha-pargot. I've heard from behind the division. That a paroches is davar ha-mavdil bein ha-melech uvein ha'am. Something that divides between the king and the people, in this instance, between the Kodesh HaKodashim and everything else. So the word paroches does not, strictly speaking, translate as curtain, but rather divider. And in fact, the Ksava Kabbalah says very interestingly that the word paroches in this respect really relates to another word that we're familiar with, which has the same shoresh, namely parech. Parech is to break. Like avodas parech, by avidim mitzrayim, it's b'nei Yisrael befarech. It's to break. Because parech is to break, a divider is a break between two things. It's mafsik, right? It breaks between two domains. And therefore the paroches is a breaker. Makes a break between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And because that's true, the Ksava Kabbalah continues. Strictly speaking, if paroches doesn't mean curtain, it's possible or conceivable that the paroches may not need to be a curtain. Now that sounds quite radical because the Torah gives you the materials and it's very much a curtain. However, we should know that in the first Beis HaMikdash, the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadoshim were divided by a wall, not by a curtain. The Beis HaMikdash of Shlomo HaMelech had a wall between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and that wall was the paroches, because the wall there served as the break. It is true, interestingly, that the entrance, of course, the wall had an entrance, otherwise you could never get in, and at the entranceway there was a smaller curtain, which was the size of a human door. Quite so. But that wasn't the paroches. The paroches was the wall, because that served as the break. In the second Beis HaMikdash, it was entirely curtain again, a very big curtain, 20 by 40 amas. But it's interesting just to see the hishtalshelut of the paroches. In the Mishkan, it was just a curtain. In the first Beis HaMikdash, it was a wall with a small curtain for the doorway. And in the second Beis HaMikdash, back to curtain again. Now, in Pasuk Lamed Gimel, Lamed Beis is the positioning of the paroches, and in Pasuk Lamed Gimel states, V'nasata es haparoches tachas akrasim, also it should be underneath the hooks, exactly at that point where the strips of the roof are joined together by hooks, that's that point, dividing point. V'hevesa shama mi beis laparoches es aron ha'edus, and you should bring there within the paroches, the Aaron ha'edus, yevdila paroches lachem min haKodesh haKodesh haKadoshim, and it should divide between the Kodesh and Kodesh haKadoshim. Now, Pasuk Lamed Beis tells us where the paroches should be. Lamed Beis states v'nasata osa alaba amudeshitim mutzupim zav vavehim zav alaba adnei kosev. That means that it should be suspended from four pillars of wood, etc., coated with gold. So Pasuk Lamed Beis tells us where the parocha should be suspended. Pasuk Lamed Gimel tells us that the Aron should be brought in behind where the parocha is. And Pasuk Lamed Gimel catches the attention of the Ramban. Because, says Ramban, it's interesting to consider. Parshas Truma is about the construction of the Mishkan, and no more. That is to say, what divides, shall we say, Parshas Truma and Tetzaveh with the later Parshas of Vayakhel and Pekudeh is that Parshas Truma and Tetzaveh is about the construction of the Mishkan, and then Vayakhel and Pekudeh are more about how things were then placed. Everything was made, but then everything was put in place. That's really much later on. And therefore it's very interesting that here in Pasuk Lamed Gimel, it's already telling you where to put the Aron. Placing the Aron is no longer connected to the construction of the Mishkan. The Aron is made, the Mishkan is made, the Paroches is there. Where you put the Aron is more about Hakamas HaMishkan. What is that doing in our parsha? It's moreover, it seems as if the pasuk is giving us a seder, namely, pasuk Lamed Bey says, "Put the paroches up," and then Lamed Gimel says, "Put the aron behind the paroches." But the Ramban points out that we see later on when it actually happened that that was not the order in which it occurred. Rather, in the end of Parshas Pekudeh in Perek Mem, pasuk Gimel, we see that actually first they put the Aron in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and then they set up the paroches. So the order is actually the other way round states Vesamta sham es aron ha'edus. You should put the aron there in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and then Vesakosa al ha'aron es ha'paroches, and then cover it and section it off with the paroches. So if in actuality first the aron was placed there and then the paroches was suspended, why then does the pasuk mention it, and even not in the order that it happened? Rather, says Ramban, here, the goal is not to tell us about the order of how things would be placed in the Mishkan, because that's not that yet the topic at hand. Rather, it's telling us the function of the paroches. What is it for? And that is twofold. The answer is twofold. Number one, to section off the Kodesh from the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and number two, to also section off the Aron. These are two separate goals and two separate functions of the paroches. That's very interesting. We normally perhaps would consider this to be one thing, to divide between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadoshim. What's in the Kodesh? The Aron, that be that as it may. But that's not really, the paroches isn't relating to that at all. It's just about the dividing between these two domains. But we see from this pasuk, which is talking purely about the function of the paroches, and it has two functions. Function number one is to divide, and function number two is to cover over the paroches. Pardon me, the aron. And it's interesting that is how the pasuk which we just quoted refers to the paroches, because in Perek Mem, pasuk Gimel, it says Visakosa al ha'aron es ha'paroches. You shall cover the aron with the paroches. Rashi says that the word Visakosa is like sukkah. It's like schach. You should provide protection, provide some type of covering. What's interesting is, says Rashi, when we think of schach, we think of a horizontal covering on top. Here, it's a vertical covering, but it has the same function of sectioning it away. And that's why it's called, that verb is called v'sakosa al ha'aron. The Torah refers to the paroches specifically as it relates to the aron, not just between the two domains of the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Ad kedei kach, that in Parshas Vayakel, the paroches is actually called the paroches hamasach. Paroches hamasach means the paroches of covering. And that is a reference, the only thing it covers, in whatever way it does, is the aron. It doesn't cover anything else. It provides schach, vertical schach, for the aron. And because of that, it's called the paroches hamasach. And these are the two things that are mentioned in the pasuk. Number one, Vevesa shama es aron ha'edus, which is its covering over of the aron. And number two, vihivdila haparoches lachem ben kodesh uvin hakodesh hakadoshim. And it's interesting to note, having identified, as we've seen, two aspects of the paroches, two functions of the paroches, and it does both. But there are times when it only does one, when the entire paroches is devoted to just one of those things. We find, for example, that there was a time when all the paroches did was to divide between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadoshim. It did not perform the function of covering over the Aron. And the reference, of course, is to the entire duration of the second Beis HaMikdash. In the second Beis HaMikdash, there was no Aron. And therefore, there was a paroches. There you see the paroches only performing the function of separating between Kodesh and Kodesh HaKadoshim alone. And for that, that's what it was doing there. Interestingly, elsewhere, we find that the paroches only performing the other function, namely, only covering the aron, and not dividing between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadoshim. What are we referring to? Well, in the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, towards the end of Parshas Bamidbar, so the pasuk tells us how to essentially fold down the Mishkan and prepare it for travel. So the kelim were put somewhere, and all the, it was dismantled and readied for transit. And in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Hey, it describes how the Aron should be prepared for transit. Uvo Aron Uvono Binso Hamachane. So Aaron and his sons, they should come when the camp is traveling. And it's very interesting just to consider what happens to the camp when they're traveling. Is there a camp when they're traveling? Does the camp dissolve? Or does it travel with them to a degree? But in any case, v'haridu es paroches hamasa, they should take down the paroches, v'chisu bo es aron ha'edus, and they should use the paroches to cover over and wrap the aron. Which is very interesting, because here we see that the paroches, there is no Kodesh or Kodesh HaKadoshim, because the Mishkan has been dismantled, but there's still an Aron, so does the paroches have a function? Yes, purely now paroches HaMasach, it is, and it's very directly covering over the Aron. Further in this matter, and the paroches now is really getting these two, we're seeing these two, what we could almost call Tzvedinim, two aspects within the paroches, is if we come back to the first Beis HaMikdash, and we mentioned that actually the most of the paroches was really a wall that Shlomo built. But at the actual entrance, there was a curtain. Now, strictly speaking, and Rashi states this in the Gemara in Maseches Menachos, strictly speaking, a wall is a partition, is an effective partition, even if there's an empty or open doorway. I mean, that's important. Most of Eruvin is based on that. Even if there's a doorway is open, but nonetheless, it is a partition. And so we find something quite fascinating. In this first Beis HaMikdash, there were two aspects to the paroches physically. There was the wall, and then there was the curtain that covered over the doorway of the wall. And actually, when you think about it, it was the wall that was the divider between the Kodesh and Kodesh HaKadoshim, and it could fulfill that function even without the curtain. It's the curtain that blocked view of the Aron, most directly, because the Aron is right there in the middle. So actually, the two aspects, the two functions of the paroches, split up between these two elements. The wall was the dividing element, and the curtain itself was the masach element. It had that function of keeping the aron away from view, which is that type of schach, kept it in the shade, so to speak. So the paroches really split up in that way. And moreover, there's even a, shall we say, a halachic reverberation here, which is pointed out by Rav Kasher in the Miluim to the Torah Shlema. It relates to something that is stated about the paroches in the Mishnah. I think it's quite a well-known statement for reasons that we'll see. The Mishnah in Maseches Shkolim, in the 8th Perek, in Mishnah Hay, describes the paroches, its dimensions, how thick it was, and how long it was, and how wide it was, 40 amos tall and 20 amos wide. And one of the things that the Mishnah states is that it was toveled in a mikveh. After all, that's quite an enterprise. If you need to tovel it in a mikveh, it's a lot. It's a big curtain. 300 kohanim used to tovel it in the mikveh. That's a lot of kohanim. And there's an interesting shaila as to whether the Mishnah means 300 literally. 300 is one of those famous numbers in the Gemara, which is used elsewhere as a loshen guzma. It means a lot. 300. Although some say that it really make a cheshbon, that there really was room for 300 kohanim to take hold of the paroches, to make a cheshbon of the tvachim, etc. Be that as it may. There is a prior question, which is a bit shocking. Namely, why would the paroches ever need to be toveled in a mikveh? Whatever needs to be toveled in a mikveh? Something that became tomei. But we have a principle. Building materials and appurtenances to building cannot be makabel tumah. binyan and machshiri binyan. Can't be mekabel tumah. You can't be metame a wool. I mean, unless it itself contracts tsaras. But a person who's tome, who touches a wall or a door, he can't be metame those things. That's a building. Only kalim, and appurtenances to kalim, vessels and utensils, they could be metame. So here's the parochas. As far as we know, the parochas is part of the binyan. It's a curtain. It serves the building. So it's not a kli. So why are we talking about how many kohanim it needed to toivel it? It should never be mekabel tumah in the first place. As Rav Kasher, you see from here that a significant aspect of the parochas, as we said, is to serve the aron. And the aron is a kli. And this aspect of the parochas that serves the aron, that makes it machshirei kelim. It's an appurtenance to a kli. And as such, it can be mekabel tumah. And the only question now is how many kohanim does it take to you need to toivel it. So that's a fascinating halachic element of the parochas. So we really see in so many different ways how the parochas had these two functions. Interestingly, though, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, in his sichas on Rashi, maintains, although he notes these two aspects, they're clear for all to see, that he feels that Rashi is saying that the dominant element is yet the dividing element. And that's what Rashi means when he, by explaining to us what the word parochas means. After all, there's so many words in the Mishkan, there's a parochas, and Rashi doesn't explain what every word means. The Mishnah talks about kreshim. What does the word keresh mean? We know what it means. It means a beam. Rashi doesn't explain. Or what is keresh, and what's adanim, and all of these things. But when it comes to the word parochas, and we could kind of work it out, Rashi explains what the word parochas means. It means a divider. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe understood that when Rashi's telling us that that's what the word means, that's Rashi's way of saying as much as this has two functions, but this is its primary function, the dividing function. That's Rashi's way of letting that know. I believe it is in place, having discussed the essence, shall we say, or the goal of the parochas, to see a halachic discussion that pertains to a parochas in Shul. And this was asked to Rav Moshe Feinstein in the Igros Moshe. The question was, there was a paroches, and it sometimes happens, there were two parts to it, and the curtains would part through a drawstring or whatever it will be. Fine, so far so good. The only problem is, sometimes people embroider things on the paroches. They could say, Eitz Chaim Hi L'machazikim Ba. These are all good things to say. The problem is when the paroches is closed, when the two curtains join together, so then everything is centered. So on one hand you have the Ayin of Eitz, and the other curtain you have the Tzadik of Eitz, and it's all good. And so on and so forth. But as you pull the string and the curtains part, so the word disassembles. And the Shaila is, are you allowed to open the paroches on Shabbos? Because there's a malacha of kosev, which is writing and forming words, and there's a malacha of mocheg, which is the opposite of kosev, which is to disassemble or to disintegrate words or letters. And the question is this acceptable? It's a very interesting notion. You could imagine a person refusing to do psicha on religious grounds. And Rav Moshe explained that in his opinion, it's mutter. And the reason why it's mutter, says Rav Moshe, is because, and it's based on a Machon Avraham, we'll spare ourselves the complications, but the upshot of the Machon Avraham, the way the Rav Moshe understands him, is that there are two elements to the malacha of kosev. It's very interesting. What are the component parts of this malacha called writing? We don't think about it because we just write without thinking, which is another problem. But certainly we don't think about what it means to write, at least a pen on paper. But actually, there are two things. The first element is the formation or creation of the letters themselves. But secondly, there is the aspect of affixing them, either affixing them to a background or affixing them vis-a-vis each other. When you write a word on a piece of paper, essentially you've done both, and that is the full act which is called writing. Number one, you've created the letter. Number two, you have affixed the letters vis-a-vis each other, otherwise known as writing a word. Now, Reb Moshe explains that the full malacha requires both. Sometimes malachas have different elements to that. You need both elements for it to be kosev on a Torah level. However, if you have one, it's also a problem. And it's possible to have one. It's possible to form a letter without affixing it anywhere. You could take Play-Doh or whatever, any type of putty, and make it into the form of a letter. And that could be a problem. Indeed, it's part of the discussion of tying knots on tefillin on Shabbos, which are, of course, instantly also due to the tying of the knot. There's also the issue that the knots are typically formed as letters. There's the Dalet and the Yud, etc. That's its own problem. It's a kosev problem. But it's not affixed to a background. It's not affixed vis-a-vis another letter. It's a letter in free fall. But you did create it. That's number one. The second point is, if the letter exists already, but you affix it, that would also be part of the malacha, not the full Torah malacha, but certainly an Issa Drabanan. And that the Magen Avraham famously says that one should not stitch silver letters onto a fabric, aside from the malacha of stitching. He held that that was Osir as kosev, even though the letters already exist, but they haven't been affixed vis-a-vis each other or anything else. When you stitch them together and thus make a word, that kvius of the letters vis-a-vis each other is an Issur. As representing part of the malacha of kosev. That is the breakdown of this malacha of writing on Shabbos. In this instance, says Reb Moshe, it seems to me that there is no problem at all, because when it comes to the first aspect of the creation of the letters, well, the letters already exist. They're already there. They're embroidered on the curtain. And when it comes to the issue of kvius, because we're saying that they're together, and then you separated them, and perhaps then maybe even worse to close afterwards because they bring them back together, but they're never affixed vis-a-vis each other. They're merely suspended. I mean, they're literally hanging in free fall next to each other, but they're not fixed vis-a-vis each other, and therefore nothing's being compromised there either, which means that there is no problem with regards to either aspect of this malacha. That's the famous psak of Reb Moshe with regards to opening the parochas. And in fact, it echoes a very similar tshuva that someone asked him. I'm not sure if this, do they still do this. Maybe the some shuls. I remember from younger times. Not everyone in shul knows what page they're on. So there's someone at the front, and they have placards and with numbers, and they tell you we're on page 199 or whatever. So the question is, to put those cards up, in a sense, writing numbers is as much a problem as writing letters. If you wrote 99, it's like you wrote Aleph Beis. Now here, they're placing the cards next to each other. These digits attain new meaning when they're stationed vis-a-vis each other. Is it permissible to put them on that board? And Reb Moshe said it's mutter, for a very similar reason. Namely, that, again, the letters themselves, the numbers themselves already exist, and they're not being affixed vis-a-vis each other, they're being placed next to each other, in which case it's completely mutter. That, for Reb Moshe, is what he considers to be the Ikar Halacha. Reb Moshe then says two additional things. He says, if you'd like to be mahader a little bit, if you'd like to go the extra mile and do things in the best possible way with regards to this paroches, so I would recommend get to shul a little bit before Shabbos and open the paroches slightly. Because if you've done that, then they're not even next to each other fully, even at the outset. And whoever closes the paroches shouldn't close it fully. That would be my mahadrin recommendation, even though on a strict halachic basis, I think it's mutter. That's the first addition. But the second edition of Reb Moshe is, if you don't mind me saying, aside from everything that we've discussed, personally, I believe that this paroches is problematic not only on Shabbos, but also during the week. And the reason is that a paroches should not have two parts to it. Why say that? Because where do we get the idea of a paroches in shul from? You get it from the paroches in the Mishkan. And the paroches in the Mishkan was one curtain, not two. And therefore there is value in the paroches being of one piece of material, so much so, says of Moshe, that if it's possible to do this without machlokus, the parochah should be replaced. Or somehow, some arrangement should be made that the two should be joined. That's very interesting. When this is, we tend to get a glimpse in the art of a posek addressing a question that wasn't asked to him. The question began in Hilchos Shabbos, and Rav Moshe says, that's fine, but it very soon developed into another question that was not asked, but Rav Moshe felt was nonetheless relevant there. So these are some paroches, shall we say, halacha lemaisa, in a sense. So let's conclude by referring to a statement of the Gemara in Maseches Shavuos, again in Daf Tet Zayin. And there the Gemara states that we find that the terms Mishkan and Mikdash can be used, in a sense, interchangeably. The Mishkan was called the Mikdash, and the Mikdash was called the Mishkan, and there is something of an interplay. Where do we see the Mishkan being called the Mikdash? Well, the very beginning of the Parsha, V'asu li Mikdash. It is the only time in Parsha's Truma, or Vayakel and Pekudei for that matter, that it's referred to as a Mikdash. Every other time it's called the Mishkan, but on this one time, it's called the Mikdash. And we remind ourselves, by the way, that works very well for the Rambam, because according to the Rambam, this is the source for all Mikdashim, not just the Mishkan. And therefore, this is the one pasuk where you have it's a Taryag message. It's the mitzvah message, and therefore it's phrased in a much more general way of Mikdash, of which Mishkan is one application. From then on, it describes the Mikdash at hand, otherwise known as the Mishkan. But the Beis HaMikdash is also known as the Mishkan. It quotes a pasuk there to that effect. And as true as that is, we do find that ultimately the Mishkan is referred to predominantly as a Mishkan, and the Beis HaMikdash is referred to predominantly as a Mikdash. And if the two really are interchangeable, as we see on these one occasion of each, why is it that for the most part they really are called two separate things, and they only meet at a certain point? And the Shemi Shmuel explains very beautifully that Mishkan and Mikdash represent two different goals. Because the Mishkan is more than one thing. And different aspects will be highlighted depending on the state of Bnei Yisrael. Mishkan derives from the word Shechina. And thus in the Mikdash Mishachanti Besocham. Mishkan literally is a dwelling place. A dwelling place for the Shechina. And that's what it's called in the Midbar. Mikdash, the word Kodesh, Rashi tells us, we translate it as sanctified or holy. Rashi tells us that Kodesh is an expression of Hafrasha, Havdalah, of separating. Hamavdi ben Kodesh l'chol. And the Shemi Shmuel explains that the goal in the Midbar was different than the goal in Eretz Yisrael. The goal in the Midbar was Mishkan. And by that we mean the Jewish people didn't really need to have a Mishkan to separate them from the physical world. Their entire existence was separated from the physical world. They're in the Midbar, and they're in the middle of nowhere. They're being sustained miraculously. Man, Be'er, Shel Miriam, Anani HaKovet. They are separate. Being separate, their goal is now what do they do? What are they aspiring for? And the answer is Mishkan. A place for the Shechina. That's how to use their state. Because everything else is really done for them. They are already Kadosh. But as we move into Eretz Yisrael and Ishtachas Gefno, Ishtachas Teinoso, and people begin to spread out and be involved in more earthly matters, the goal of the Beis HaMikdash also changes now. It takes on a more urgent and basic function. The Mikdash is there to ensure that people remain distinct from being completely engrossed and immersed and enmeshed in physical existence. That's called Mikdash. That's the goal. the Beis HaMikdash as the center of Jewish life is to ensure that people remain elevated as much as they're occupied, that they don't become preoccupied. And thus we find that in the two different domains, the two different planes, the goal in the Midbar is is Mishkan, v'shachanti b'socham. And the goal in Eretz Yisrael is Mikdash, be involved in the world, be involved in the land, but it shouldn't, they shouldn't be consumed by it, but rather remain elevated. That's the reminder of the Mikdash. Of course, ultimately, there is interplay between the two, and that's why the Mishnah, the Gemara says that Mikdash will be called Mishkan, and the Mishkan will be called Mikdash. The entire Mishkan experience of the Jewish people in the Midbar was not to be terminated as they moved into Eretz Yisrael. On the contrary, this is the seminal experience of the Jewish people. This is their launch into Eretz Yisrael. They need to be primed, they need to be prepared through that Mishkan in order to keep that going. Which means that as much as there's another challenge as they enter Eretz Yisrael, which is called Mikdash, they shouldn't lose sight of the Mishkan that they had. On the contrary, the goal of remaining separate from the land and from mundane things and above that in Eretz Yisrael is ultimately in order to bring about the presence of the Shekhinah in Eretz Yisrael itself. And that is why the Mikdash is also called a Mishkan, and the Mishkan is also called a Mikdash. These two goals and values empower each other. So these are pertinent themes. We have currently the opportunity only to discuss the Asudin Mikdash, but it seems from the Rambam, as Rabbi Pesach Frank points out, the Rambam seems to indicate, as he has a posuk of introduction for each of his 14 Sfarim, and the opening pasuk for Avoda is Sha'ali Shalom Yerushalayim, Yishlo Ayavaych, seek out the peace of Yerushalayim. And the Rambam put this as his header for the halachos of Binyan Beis HaBechira, of building a Beis HaMikdash. And as Rav Pesach Frank understood from this, that the Rambam is saying that by talking about the halachos of Binyan Beis HaBechira, that itself is a spiritual step and fulfillment to a degree. As surely as we say that being involved in the halachos of korbanos is like bringing a korban, so the Rambam is telling us here, Shali Shalom Yerushalayim, we're seeking out the welfare of Yerushalayim and moving forward to the building. By talking about the building, that's as close as we can get until opportunities become available, and that should happen b'mehira b'yameinu.